The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
You know how Donald Trump keeps saying he's going to make America great again? Turns out the great might be short for Great Depression, because today the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 799.36 points. Well, at least it wasn't 800. For sure. Here's the thing. It might have been Trump's fault, because it was. On Sunday, he announced, he said, he tweeted out, they had this great new trade deal with China, tweeting, China has agreed to reduce and remove tariffs on cars coming into China from the U.S. Currently, the tariff is 40%. That's great news. Now, here's the thing. When he tweeted that out, tariff gone, the Dowlings over at the Dow heard this, and yesterday they surged up more than 400 points, except this tariff deal wasn't true. And here's how you can tell. The president said it. There's no deal. No details, nothing. In fact, it was such a blatant lie, even the Fox and Friends weren't buying it. Check out Fox and Friends' interview with the White House economic advisor and the Crypt Keeper's wingman, Larry Kudlow.
The president tweeted out something about we're getting rid of the 40% tariffs on cars. You know, we haven't heard anything official about that. Can you explain what happened?
I think it's coming. Okay, and I'll
tell
you why.
Well, he already told us. What? Give us some details.
Come on, Larry. We're sitting on this couch putting our asses on the line for you guys every day. Give it to me straight. Where are the details of the China deal, and why hasn't the caravan murdered me yet? Now, Kudlow, he went on to explain that the tariff reduction that Trump announced was more of an aspiration.
It hasn't been signed and sealed and delivered yet. But look, I think they're going to go to zero. All right. My view, I think the president expects them to go to zero.
You can't just say something happened because you expect it's going to. Now, Trump and Xi did agree to a sort of tariff ceasefire period. Kudlow initially said the Chinese had 90 days from January 1st, but then the White House corrected him to say the 90 days actually began on December 1st. Well, he doesn't need to be good with numbers. He's only the White House economic advisor. But what really made the Wall Street S&P its pants is when Trump today admitted the deal isn't done, tweeting, the negotiations with China have already started. Unless extended, they will end 90 days from the date of our wonderful and very warm dinner with President Xi in Argentina. Bob Lighthizer will be working closely with Steve Mnuchin, Larry Kudlow, Wilbur Ross, and Peter Navarro. Oi. Dot, 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 on seeing whether or not a real deal with China is actually possible. If it is, we will get it done. China is supposed to start buying agricultural product and more immediately.
Huh?
Agricultural product? Singular?
Look, I'm negotiating with a carrot and stick approach. I am insisting that China buy a carrot, and they have told me where to stick it.
Ah, yes. Oh, Stephen Colbert from a couple of nights ago. Obviously, the stock market wasn't open yesterday because of the, you know, Papa Doc's funeral. Sorry, the funeral was today. Papa Doc's, I don't know, memorial in Washington, D.C. yesterday. I'm really sick of these death tours. The casket going back and forth and people coming out to show their, I don't know what, to wave at a casket? I honestly don't get it. He's dead. The time to go and visit him would have been when he was alive, just saying. Anyway, a lot going on today. I am Nicole Sandler. Thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday. Busy, busy Thursday. In fact, we're going to get started right now by calling John Nichols of The Nation.
John Nichols.
Hey, John Nichols, are you there?
I totally am. I'm glad to be with you.
Hey, I'm always great to talk to you, although I really hate what we're going to talk about today. John Nichols, again, in addition to obviously being the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, your family has been in Wisconsin for how many generations?
Yeah, it depends on how you count, but six or seven.
Six or seven.
Going back to 1825.
Wow. So you've seen it all in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, ground zero for the labor movement in this country, a progressive, I don't know what word to say, but a progressive state, to be sure. Although this week, with the Democrats winning power, the Republicans are doing everything they can to make sure the Democrats don't have any power. And it's not unique to Wisconsin. This is happening in at least four states where there's this major Republican power grab going on before the Democrats, who've been duly elected to office, take power. Is this something new, or is this just a continuation of Republican practices?
No, this is very, very new, and it is very much a new strategy. It's a twist on things. Now, it's not new in the scheme of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I can point to a number of countries where things like this happen. They're just not countries that we would want to emulate.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, this is bad stuff. When you upset the peaceful transition of power, when you say, no, we've always had a situation where Democrats win and then the Republicans cede power, Republicans win and the Democrats cede power. But from here on out, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to say that whoever is holding on to power in the aftermath of an election they have lost gets to do a final rewrite of the rules, so that they are able to continue to guide certain relationships, make determinations as regards appointments and policies, but also lock in structures that are politically beneficial to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagine if you could do that in your marriages.
There'd be a lot less
divorce,
probably. Or
in your
probably.
Relationships
yeah.
with your kids.
Right.
Or make the list of stuff where, you know, once something has gone awry for you, right,
mm-hmm.
you get to then do a whole kind of rewrite of the rules at that late stage.
Yeah.
Now, might be a lot of fun, might make our lives easier, but
if you're a dictator,
that's not how we...
Right.
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 It's not how we do personal relationships, mm-hmm. because we know that, you know, things go bad, things go difficult. We've got to, you know, work from that new place. It's not how we do business relationships. You don't get to fail in business and then say, oh, well, now I'm going to rewrite the rules and you know, have it my way. Unless, of course,
you're Donald
Wall
Trump
Street and you collapse the global economy.
Right, right.
And then they do a bailout for you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, overall, our basic structure is you lose. You got to take the consequences of that.
And
what's happening in Wisconsin...
Yeah.
And in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
to some extent North Carolina, in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Intriguingly enough, at the county level, down in Phoenix, Arizona, and Maricopa County, we have instances where Republicans, and this is all Republicans at this moment, although I warn that if this becomes the practice, Democrats might well end up doing the same thing.
Sure.
But all Republicans at this point, all defeated, all, you know, for lack of a better term, victims of the wave, you know, people that got hit by it.
Right.
And in most cases, people who thought they had gained the system sufficiently to retain power, suddenly realizing that they hadn't,
mm-hmm.
and deciding, oh, well, we'll game it again. We'll do another twist on things. And in Wisconsin, what they are seeking to do is it operates on multi-tiers. I'll tell it very quickly. Mm-hmm. Very similar to Michigan. You had a situation on November 6th where Democrats won every statewide constitutional office.
Right.
Now, that's pretty unprecedented. It hasn't happened since 1982 in Wisconsin. They won governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general. They won a U.S. Senate race as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring, they won a state Supreme Court race. So it's, or at least a liberal one, state Supreme Court race. So you have a pretty remarkable period. It's a sign that the Democrats, the progressives, are coming back in a major way politically. Some of that relates to Trump, but some of that also relates to the abuses that have occurred under Republican governance over the last 8 years.
Sure, and Wisconsin has seen its fair share of it. We've seen protests and a lot of action going on at the state capitol in Wisconsin, where people have been fighting back against Scott Walker. So this has been a battle that's been waging for a few years now.
And the same in Michigan, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. Michigan
right.
didn't get quite as much coverage, but
right.
you had the takeovers, the emergency manager takeovers
right.
of Detroit. Pontiac.
Yep, yep.
You also had a real right to work battle up there on labor rights. So you have these two states where the Democrats just really like just swept in Michigan. I just told you about Wisconsin and Michigan. They won the governorship, the attorney general's job, and the secretary of state for the first time since 1986.
Wow.
So they have those three positions. So what's happened is the Republicans look at this and they say, wow, this isn't good, man. We're disempowered. But they still have the gerrymandered state legislature.
Hmm.
So with the lame duck governor, the governor is going out of office in January, and the legislature, these Republicans have decided to do dozens of new laws, resolutions, structural changes that are all designed to shift power to them. Now, at one level, they are locking in laws that were governor's executive orders. They're basically saying, oh, the governor did this, but that could be undone by the next governor. So now we're going to put it on the law books as, something that's structurally permanent.
Right.
And that's the first thing they're doing. That's a big deal because they're taking away the ability of the new governor often to act on things that new governor was elected to act on.
Sure. I mean, that's what the people voted for. And the problem is the legislature is, because of gerrymandering, is still under Republican control. So if you're thinking, well, the new legislature can just come in and undo what they did, that's not going to happen because it's a Republican legislature.
That's right. And there's a sort of, an ugly sweet spot, if you will. And that is that for this period from the November 6th election until mm-hmm. early January,
lame duck,
when the outgoing governor and the Republican legislature are there and on the same page, if they pass laws, those laws can't be undone because the new governor won't have that combination of the executive and the legislature.
Sure.
So they're locking in laws. That's a big deal. The second thing that they're doing is moving structural power. And this is in many ways an even bigger deal. What they're doing is saying, well, we just ended up with attorneys general who are on the other side, who we don't agree with politically, who might use the power of the office of attorney general to withdraw from lawsuits against Obamacare, which is the new attorney general in Wisconsin. That's what he ran on. He promised to do that.
Sure. That's what the people voted for.
Right. They're taking away his ability to do that.
Amazing.
And they're saying also you can't participate in new lawsuits, i.e. to defend immigrant rights or refugee rights or abortion rights or something like that without the permission of the legislature. So suddenly they're turning the attorneys general in Wisconsin and in Michigan. Both states just elected great new AGs. They're turning them into extensions of the legislature rather than statewide constitutional offices.
Wow.
And that's a big, big shift. I mean, that really moves power away from somebody who's elected to do something.
Sure.
Now, that's the second, and they're doing that somewhat with governors. In Michigan, they're doing a real dialing down of the powers of the Secretary of State, who's a fabulous woman named Jocelyn Benson, who was elected on a promise to defend voting rights and to really step up in a big way on campaign finance issues. They're taking away oversight of campaign finance and a lot of election stuff from her. They're literally shifting the power away from her. So she was elected saying, hey, I want to get in there and really, you know, clean up our politics. And they're saying, well, I'm sorry. By the time you're sworn in, you're not going to be overseeing any politics.
Right.
You're not going to oversee this. So that's, this is all the structural stuff. And then the final thing that I think is really important to be conscious of, Nicole, is that in a number of these places, and you see this a little in North Carolina, you definitely see it in Wisconsin, they are trying to change voting rules, regulations, laws in a way that makes it harder to have high turnout elections because they lost a high turnout election.
Right. And,
so they're intervening on that.
And that's what tends to happen. The higher the voter turnout, the better it is for the Democrats. It just works out that way. That's why all the voter suppression tactics are in place in so many states, because they don't want you to vote. The more people that vote, the worse it is for the Republicans. So this was a huge turnout election. And the Republicans lost big time in Wisconsin and Michigan. And the Republicans are doing this major power grab. Now, they already voted it in the dead of night in Wisconsin. I guess it was the day before yesterday, I think, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning.
Technically, it was yesterday.
Well, it was yesterday.
It went so long.
Right. it's amazing.
The funny thing about it was because it was occurring at 5 in the morning, we sort of, you know, mentally structure back to the previous
day. Before. No.
But it was such chaos, Nicole. I don't wish you'd been there because it wasn't a very pretty picture, but it is, you would have been fascinated by it. You literally had, they called the legislature into session. They didn't even have the bills agreed upon.
Wow.
And so they were racing through the hallways and having, you know, multiple hour, you know, meetings and recessing and calling themselves back in and arguing and pushing. It was just absurd. It was a complete chaos. And then finally at like 6, 7, 8 in the morning, they passed dozens of laws, you know, with minimal debate. I mean, literally, people couldn't possibly have read it. Even now, I talk to, you know, senior reporters, top legislators, others, who say, I don't know what was in there.
Wow.
You know, you can't possibly, because it was, you know, this is massive, you know, hundreds of bits and pieces of governance all being shifted. And here's where it gets really interesting, or at least, you know, intriguing. All of this is now put on the desk in Wisconsin of Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Scott Walker is the most powerful veto pin in the United States. Wisconsin has historically had a very strong governor. And so as a result, all of this mishmash, this chaos is on Scott Walker's desk, a guy who the voters of Wisconsin just voted out from office.
Right.
And he has essentially the final say now on a radical restructuring of state government. He can veto some things. He can enhance some things. He has an immense amount of power there. But this is an absurdity. The guy who got beat is now the most powerful figure, not merely for the last month or so of his office, but defining his successors.
Amazing. Position. Amazing. John Nichols. So, I mean, obviously, it's not against the law because the Republicans during this lame duck session are still in office. So they can do what they're supposed to do. But this is not what they're supposed to do. This time they're trying to negate the will of the voter. There's nothing that can be done about it, is there?
There's a little bit of recourse. I always counsel that your best instruction on this is to watch movies where amazing things happen at the most unexpected moment. We are dealing here at an intersection of the law, governance, and politics.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of entry points that are of consequence. The governor who's coming in, despite everything the legislature has done, will still have that incredibly powerful veto pen, and he'll have oversight of the budget. So some of this potentially can be cleaned up in a budget negotiation, right? Because you can literally say, I'm not going to fund. Like, I'll give you an example. The state legislature just decided that they don't want the Attorney General of Wisconsin to represent the legislature on a bunch of issues. So they set up basically their own legal department.
Oh, my God.
So they could have lawyers for the legislature appearing in court opposite the Attorney General of the state.
Wow.
Now, that's complete chaos. That's a legal nightmare. That may actually create a situation where a judge might say, hey, you know, you got to sort that out. You can't do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't, what the governor might be able to say is, you know, we're not going to fund that. As you know, we're going to have a fight here on shaping this budget. The legislature will say, no, of course we're going to fund it. In some areas, the budget battles of early next year may clean up a little of this. Legal cases may clean up a little of this. Also, the new governor has the ability to appoint people. It's theoretically possible he could appoint people from the legislature and may shift some of the balances there. And then also in 2020, there will be elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't like the response that simply says there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
The fact of the matter is what the Republicans did, and I disapprove of it. I think it's fundamentally damaging and destructive, and it is bad. But what they did was they went to the most extreme place of trying to game the system in every way they could.
Right.
Now, Democrats, as they come to power, I don't want them to game the system. I don't want them to, you know, get down in the gutter with these guys. But I do want them to use every vehicle they have, every tool they have, to try and turn some of this back. And I think they'll have some success in that regard. But not it's a chaotic, awful way to transition power.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very frustrating for the voters, because the voters voted for something, and
sure,
now they're clearly going to be denied at least some elements of it. And then finally, again, the one thing that is going to be very hard to claw back is some of this structural stuff. And again, I go to the Michigan case, which is still a fight.
Mm-hmm.
If you move the oversight of campaign finance reform out from under the Secretary of State and set it up in another structure, another place, that's going to be very hard to undo. And that's a case where politicians, potentially of both parties, have created a situation where they get to decide how they're regulated.
Right.
And that just feeds a cynicism about our politics that is scorching.
Yeah.
And awful and just bad.
The other thing that is so frightening is what this portends. John Nichols, you wrote a piece at The Nation a couple of days ago. The headline reads, "State Republicans are refusing to honor the peaceful transition of power." This is what really scares me, because I've heard Bill Maher say it a few times, that he's afraid that when Trump ultimately loses power, he won't accept the results and will refuse to leave, will refuse the peaceful transfer of power. That's a hallmark of democracy. It's why this country has survived all these years. This we're seeing it not only in Wisconsin, but Michigan to an extent, in Ohio, and what's going on in North Carolina is insane as well. It's like the world or America under Trump rule. The rules are gone. They make them up as they go along. And I worry also that he's not going to cede power when the time comes. Although part of me says he wants out of there so badly because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing.
Well, I think Pence will go first, but then ultimately I think Trump.
I hope you're right.
But look, here you're getting to the heart of the matter here. One of the reasons I've written so much about this and why I keep on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have a piece at The Nation today with the headline, "The Republican Party has become, quote unquote, a conspiracy to seize power."
Right.
And the quote comes from Dwight Eisenhower, who said a party that, you know, abandons its principles and abandons respect for the rule of law becomes simply a conspiracy to seize power. And I think that what you're going to hear, Nicole, is exactly the right concern.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that you see Republicans at the state level who have often been very influential. The ideas that Scott Walker initiated have gone up to the federal level in many cases. You see them gaming the process and looking for ways to not follow the rules even after they've lost an election. Well, at the federal level, we also have a situation where our November election is followed by a more than 2-month lame duck period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people have every reason to ask questions about, to be concerned about the idea of Mitch McConnell and, you know, Donald Trump doing mischief. You know, let's say Trump gets beat in 2020, doing mischief from, you know, November 2020 until January 2021.
Absolutely.
It's concerning because, now this is the interesting thing about it, because the House of Representatives, now under Democratic control, and it will be at that point, will, of course, be able to upset some things. It will be able to, use the power of the purse in some ways. But let's say Trump loses and then goes on a stunning spree of appointing judges.
Yep.
Right? Or appointing people to commission, you know, officers. There's all sorts of stuff that you can do that falls short of, you know, certainly isn't, you know, pure totalitarianism.
Sure. But in Wisconsin yesterday, the Republicans pushed through 82 of Scott Walker's nominees in one day, most of which had not had a hearing. So this is, you know, this is a harbinger of things that could be coming.
That's exactly right. And so this isn't totalitarianism in the classic sense or something like that. It's not, you know, the worst tyranny you've ever seen. But it is an absolute abuse of democracy and of the basic principles of American governance. And it does two things. Number one, it extends the power of a president or a governor who's been defeated into the term of the next, right? Via appointments, via all sorts of other structural things.
Sure.
That's really bad. And then number two, it fosters a cynicism which will lead to one of two things, or maybe both, a new kind of politics where both parties, you know, feel like they have to screw the other guys over if they lose, right?
Right.
It becomes this sort of, you know, race to the bottom, right? And or a situation where voters become so cynical about it because they say, look, whoever wins, nothing changes. They just, you know, keep doing what they do and they disempower the other guy and all this. And we drive people away from the political process itself.
Oh,
yeah. So this is bad. This is really bad stuff. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to presume that it's irreversible. We also don't have to presume that it portends the worst possible, you know, collapse of all things. What we should look at it is a very clear-eyed, very serious way and say, if this is the start of a new approach, of this is where we're heading, is this what it's going to be from here on out, then we are inviting chaos that does two things. One, it locks in corrupt status quo. Two, it undermines democracy at a fundamental level. And that ought to be the thing that brings all of us to the barricades.
Absolutely. And Republicans should be decrying this as well. I mean, this shouldn't be a left-right thing. This should be a right and wrong thing. And, you know, the people have spoken, and the Republicans are just actively going against the wishes of the electorate, which should be illegal, but it's not. John Nichols, people can find you on Twitter at Nichols Uprising, of course, at The Nation, where, again, your piece today, the Republican Party has become a conspiracy to seize power. You're doing some great work on this. Thank you for elevating the conversation, because I don't hear enough coverage of this in the media. I don't see it. This should be the lead story everywhere.
Well, thank you, Nicole, because I happen to agree with you. I think this is as big or bigger than anything we're seeing in D.C.
Yep.
Partially because of it, what exists with itself, but also because of what it pretends potentially for other places. And I love what Bill Maher said the other day, which is that, you know, he basically sent a tweet out and he said, media, do your job.
Yeah.
Well, part of our job is to cover the states.
That's it. John Nichols, thank you so much. I always appreciate your input, and today especially. I really appreciate it.
Honored to be with you, Nicole. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. John Nichols of The Nation. Again, find him on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. We're going to take a quick break. We've got What's News. I've got an update on all these four states and the shenanigans they're pulling in there. And when we come back on the other side, Howie Klein will be with us. He'll be in one place or another. We'll have to track him down, but we got Howie Klein coming up, so stick around. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Congress is back at work, dealing with a looming government shutdown after pausing on Wednesday for the state funeral of former President George H.W. Bush. Trump has verbally agreed to the short-term fix, but has threatened to shut the government down if a long-term spending package doesn't include $5 billion for a border wall. Democrats have said they're open to providing about $1.6 billion in funding for border security. If the continuing resolution passes on Thursday as expected, the White House and lawmakers will have 2 weeks to hash out their differences. The Senate Judiciary Committee canceled votes on nearly two dozen judicial nominees for the second time in 2 weeks. Senate Republicans are at an impasse with Senator Jeff Flake, who has said he will block Trump's judicial nominees unless there is a vote on a bill to protect special counsel Robert Mueller. The Washington Post is reporting that representatives of the Saudi Arabian government reserved hundreds of rooms at the Trump International Hotel in Washington shortly after the 2016 election. MSNBC's Chris Hayes has the details.
New reporting that Saudi Arabia used U.S. military veterans to pump money into a Trump hotel. The Washington Post reports that lobbyists representing the Saudi government paid for an estimated 500 rooms at President Trump's D.C. hotel in the months after his election. The total bill for those trips, more than $270,000. According to the Post, the lobbyists rented the rooms ostensibly as part of a pressure campaign to overturn legislation opposed by the Saudi government. The lobbyists offered veterans a free trip to Washington if they then went to Capitol Hill to lobby against the law. Several veterans told the Post the trips featured fancy dinners in a Trump hotel dining room, an open bar that was frequently extended. One of the veterans said he was confused by the opulent nature of the trips until one of the organizers, who'd been drinking mini-bar champagne, mentioned a Saudi prince. I said, oh, we were just used to give Trump money.
Post-election problems have surfaced in a few states where Republicans are doing all they can to restrict the power of incoming Democrats who won control. In Wisconsin, state Democrats are considering legal action after the Republican-held legislature approved a series of measures that would restrict the power of incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call. During the lame duck session, Republicans voted to reduce the number of early voting days, require legislative backing for certain decisions traditionally made by the governor and attorney general, and change the way the legislature could represent itself in court. State Democrats say the moves don't just undermine the incoming leaders, they undermine the entire electoral process. Michigan is following Wisconsin's lead. Senator Debbie Stabenow explains what's happening there.
This is a complete insult to the people of Michigan who voted a month ago for change. They voted for a Democratic governor and lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general to make change happen. And so here's what the Republicans are doing to be able to protect power. First of all, they are voting at moving bills to take away campaign finance oversight from the secretary of state. Our Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, literally wrote the book on campaign finance and voter protection. People in Michigan voted for ballot proposals to add more opportunities to vote, to protect the vote. Secondly, for the Attorney General, they want to set up a way for the Republicans in the legislature to have equal standing on lawsuits. So when our Attorney General brings a lawsuit against polluters to protect our water or health care to protect pre-existing conditions, they want, as Republicans, to be able to have equal standing to be able to bring a taxpayer lawsuit on the other side.
Meanwhile, in North Carolina's 9th District, we're seeing evidence of actual election fraud. CNN has the story.
The voting irregularities in North Carolina's 9th District congressional race are part of a criminal investigation that began in January and include possible vote fraud that could have affected the outcomes in three elections. Among the allegations, more than 1,000 absentee ballots from likely Democratic voters were gathered and destroyed.
You're looking at several thousand or approximately 2,000 absentee ballot requests from this most recent election. About 40% of those, it appears at this point, may not have been returned.
Lauren Freeman, the district attorney for Wake County, North Carolina, was sent this letter back in January by the district attorney of Bladen County, asking for help to investigate voter fraud allegations and possible false statements to affect election outcomes allegedly perpetrated by McCray Dallas, a political operative hired by Republican congressional candidate Mark Harris. Harris won the 9th district race in a squeaker, just 905 votes. But that vote count is now in doubt because the operation run by McCray Dallas could have affected more than 1,000 of the votes.
The New York Times is reporting that global greenhouse gas emissions have been growing at an alarming rate in 2018, with scientists comparing the pace to a, quote, speeding freight train. Two studies published Wednesday warn that the rapid increase of carbon dioxide emissions will likely bring about the most severe consequences of global warming sooner than expected. Scientists also said the unexpected surge in oil consumption, which has offset progress made by the sale of electric vehicles, is partly to blame.
I got the news.
And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. And just a quick addendum, a couple of stories have been updated since I recorded What's News this morning. The Senate today passed a bill by voice vote to avert a shutdown and fund the federal government for another 2 weeks. The House passed the legislation earlier this morning. The stopgap measure gives Congress and Donald Trump until just before Christmas to resolve a fight over the ridiculous border wall. We're already expecting Mueller's sentencing documents on Paul Manafort tomorrow. Well, a federal judge in New York has ordered that the Southern District of New York prosecutors in the special counsel's office have until 5 p.m. also tomorrow to deliver their sentencing memoranda in the Michael Cohen case. Should be exciting. Stay tuned. All right, coming up next, Howie Klein. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're gonna love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and French fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 orange juice. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acidic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on The Nicole Sandler Show.
And, of course, the Blue America Pack as well. I'm not sure if Howie's going to be here or not. We might have to get him on his cell phone, but we'll find out. Howie, you there? No. All right. I had a feeling and there was no way to know for sure. So let's reach Howie on his cell phone and hopefully he'll be there to pick up right away. We'll see. He had a thing he had to do today. Calling Howie Klein. There he is. Hey, Howie. Howie Klein.
Yes.
So we have a resident of Burlington, Vermont, who's a regular in the chat room. Her name is Gina. And last week when I mentioned Bernie Palooza, she was all excited and off the air, she asked me if you were there. And I said, she's like, I'm fangirl. What is it okay if I stalk him? I said, well, see if you can find him.
Of course it would be okay. Uh-huh. I'll tell you a great story about stalking.
Okay.
You're gonna love this. So I don't want to name the person, but there's a woman who I follow her activism. She's a great, great activist, and I really admire her.
Okay.
And I thought I had never met her, and she came up to me and she introduced herself, and I sort of made like a little bowing gesture, and she said, no, stop. I feel like I should be doing that
to
you.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you probably don't remember, but I'm 44 now, and when I was 17, we met. And I said, oh, what were the circumstances? And she said, we were both at Madison Square Garden seeing Morrissey.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I rushed the stage, and as I was being dragged out by the police, you came up to me and gave me a backstage pass, and I've always wanted to thank you.
Oh,
ever
how
since.
Funny. That's a great
how
story.
How long ago was that?
Wow. That's a great story. And the fact that she knew who you were and made the connection from all those years ago. That's
yeah.
Very
and
cool.
the funny part about this is I admire her so much as an activist. She's really, really good. And normally when people come up to me about Morrissey, it's always, you're a jerk. all my life I've been waiting to meet Morrissey and I finally got a chance to give him a hug and then you dragged me away. And what they don't know is that he would give me like hand signals when to get people.
Oh, how funny!
It wasn't my fault. I didn't care if they hugged him or not. He didn't want it. Sometimes he wanted it. A lot of times he didn't. So I'm always getting like these awful things from, you know, Morrissey fanatics saying, oh, that horrible Howie Klein, he, you know, ruined my time with Morrissey. I never did it to anybody. It was always him.
I hear you. So I know people are like that with Bernie. You know, they treat him like a star. He doesn't seem to appreciate that kind of worship. You know, he's just a regular guy. Did you get to spend any quality time with him?
No, I wouldn't call it quality time. What happened was I had never met him.
Mm-hmm.
He's aware that there's a guy who went to his elementary school and his high school, uh-huh. and who is an admirer of his, but that he didn't really put that together. So I went over and introduced myself to him, and that was nice.
Uh-huh.
And then he sort of started asking me a few things about high school, and I explained. He had already graduated by the time I started, and he shook his head. And then I said, yeah, I was in Chuck Schumer's class. So he had a big smile in a very friendly way. He said, were you in classes with Chuck? He said it in a very positive way about Schumer. And instead of reacting properly, I started cursing Schumer, and Bernie got freaked out and ran away.
Oh, no. Well, Schumer had it coming.
That was my one interaction with Bernie.
That's funny. But was it a productive meeting? I heard the one criticism I heard of it was that they didn't make allowances to have local activists and Bernie supporters there, that it, you know, the local people were sort of dissed. But everything else I heard about it was great.
I met plenty of people from Vermont and New Hampshire, lots of them.
Great.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was by invitation only.
Yeah.
But they definitely invited people from both states. I met lots of them.
In fact,
I was just going through the cards I had brought home with me this morning, and I was writing down some of the phone numbers of people, you know, new friends of mine from New England.
Oh, great. Well, okay. Well, good. So the weather wasn't too bad?
The weather was, for me, I mean, I think up there they don't think it was bad, but, you know, I'm a California guy now.
Yep.
So I'm not used to snow and freezing, and and for me, I would wear like, you know, 5 layers, and I see some of them walking around with nothing but a sweater.
Wow!
I haven't been this cold since I was walking in the Himalayas. It was so freezing. The meetings were great.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was just saying on Twitter a little while ago that I was reacting to something that someone said. And I said, and I was talking about a panel on the Green New Deal that Bill McKibben was holding, and he gave this great line, which is, you know, that politicians in general, both conservative Democrats and Republicans, have to understand you can't compromise with physics. You know, they're not going to, like, you know, try to make a deal with you. Physics is what physics is.
Right.
No deals.
Right.
And until politicians start to understand that they're not negotiating with, you know, someone like Alexandria Ocasio, it's not up to her.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do what she says because she's got the right idea. But it's not about, you know, hey, we'll give you a 50%. No, that's not the way physics works. You do it and that's it, or you perish.
Right. Well, at least the Democrats are talking about that. And so Bernie was...
Some of them.
Some of them.
I mean, you know, it scares me that right now there are only 18 Democrats, and no Republicans, of course, but only 18 Democrats have signed on to the Green New Deal. That's it. 18.
Where's the rest of the Progressive Caucus that allegedly is going to grow to be the biggest caucus?
I'd like to know where they are as well. I mean, it's kind of scary. You know, in California, we just elected seven new members of Congress. So there are 7 freshmen. I don't know if every single one of them campaigned on these issues, but most of them did.
Mm-hmm.
And only one of them has signed on. Mike Levin from down in the southern part of Orange County and northern San Diego County. Well, Mike signed on to it. And where's everybody else? There's 6 others. I want to see their names on there. I don't understand why they're not there. It's getting me a little bit frightened.
And there aren't even offices that people can call yet to urge them. So as soon as they get their offices, it's time to start calling in.
That's right. I'm not going to freak out about it until everyone's settled into their offices.
But
I do admire Mike for jumping right in there along with some of the freshmen from the East Coast, like Alexandria, of course, and Rashida Tlaib. Ayanna, I should say, Presley. You know, there are. I don't remember how many of these 18 are freshmen, but there were at least 7 or 8 freshmen.
Wow!
I was really happy to see Ted Lieu, my adopted congressman, sign on to this thing right off the bat. You know, my own congressman is Adam Schiff,
right,
who's a conservative Democrat, and he'll never sign on. He'll be one of the ones who wants to compromise, and you know, not understanding why you can't compromise on something like this. So you know, instead of dealing with him, who I can't deal with, I just tell myself that Ted Lieu, whose district is right next door, that he's my congressman.
Sure, and I'm sure he's fine with that. So did Bernie address, I'm sure, the elephant in the room, the 2020 race? Did he say anything about whether or not he'll be running?
Yes. So, and basically, I'll lead into that by talking about something else.
Okay.
A guy who I've known for 15 years online is his, I guess you would, I don't know, assistant campaign manager, or I don't know what the exact title is, but that would be, in effect, he's the assistant campaign manager.
Okay.
And he's an old friend, and I had never met him in person.
Huh.
So he's someone who I've known really well for 15 years and never met face-to-face. So it was really great for us to meet each other. And I said to him, so what's going on? I mean, you guys are working. So Bernie's running, right? And he said, well, we don't know. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, honestly, what Bernie says in public is exactly what he says in private. He said, we're not getting anything different from Bernie, even if we sit around with him for a whole day, than what you get from him on the news. It's the same thing.
Wow.
And that is basically, it's 50-50. Now, that said, another person who was, let's say, an intimate of Bernie's, told me 50-50 is not accurate, and it's closer to 70-30.
Okay.
70 in favor.
Wow.
So I don't know, you know, I don't know what that means. I don't know who to put my faith in. I would go up and down in my mood, depending on if it was like 51% running or 49% running. You know, if it was more than 50-50, I was feeling really good. And if it was less than 50-50, I was really down and dejected.
Right.
And as you know, I know you mentioned it on Twitter, I'm in the middle of a series.
Yes.
Do you remember the name of the series?
Yes,
exactly?
The series is called The Worst Democrats Who Want to Be President. And so far, you've done parts 1 through 4. With part 4
right.
coming up yesterday.
I've already like been made to feel bad about part 1. I mean,
oh,
every
really?
Time I put one of these up, the person who I'm writing about calls screaming.
Uh-oh.
And if they don't call me, they call like a friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
So the first one I did was Tulsi Gabbard.
Right.
And as you know, I had been writing some really harsh stuff about her for years.
Yes.
And then about a year ago, I just stopped. I just thought to myself, you know what? I should just stop writing about her. Bernie sees something in her.
Yeah.
And I should just leave it be. I don't have to say anything good. I don't have to say anything bad. I just shouldn't say anything. I have, you know, 50 posts that I've done about her.
Right.
And I don't need to write any more about her. And then what's been happening over the last year is that anytime anybody wants to, not anybody, but many, many people who want to say something bad about Tulsi, they use my stuff.
Sure.
So my stuff is always on Twitter.
Right.
And they're, you know, using me as a source for their anti-Tulsi stuff. So anyway, I lifted the moratorium on saying nasty stuff about Tulsi because she is running for president. So I wrote one of these things on her.
Well, she's frustrating. She's really frustrating because, you know, she came out so strongly for Bernie, and people just assume because of the association there that she's got to be progressive like Bernie without doing the homework. Because if they did any homework, if they Googled her, read some of your pieces about her, they'd find out she's not exactly progressive.
Well, so she calls up one of my closest friends.
Uh-oh.
And who is also at Bernie Palooza.
Uh-huh.
And she says, so I hear that Howie is back from Turkey. And I'm thinking, how the hell does she know, even know I'm in Turkey? And that he's going to be at Bernie Palooza. And I'm thinking, how does she know I'm going to be in Bernie Palooza? I hadn't even RSVP'd at that point. And she says to him, set up a meeting. So he calls me up. He says, so you got to do this for me. You got to meet with her. And I said, come on, it's going to be really uncomfortable for me. I mean, what is this? You know, he said, it won't be. It'll be fine. She just wants to have a dialogue and tell you answer your questions. You should do it. I said, okay, I will. So I did it, and it was really nice. It was a very, very pleasant experience. I got to know her a little bit more. She was very forthcoming with the questions that I asked her. And, you know, and I've, and it's already sort of, in a way, for me, as a blogger, it's already paid off because I was doing a story on this Green New Deal the other day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tulsi was one of the first people. I said there were only 18 people. She was one of the first ones to sign on to it.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, she put herself out in something that really is, you know, no one agrees with everybody on every single issue. It doesn't exist.
Nope.
But, you know, on the issue, there are issues that, you know, she and I see eye to eye on, absolutely. And one of them happens to be something that's, you know, maybe the most important thing in the world, which is this, all of the issues around the Green New Deal.
Sure.
So, you know, climate change obviously is a big one. So she was, you know, so I wrote her a note and I said, hey, Tulsi, it was nice to meet you. You want to give me a quote on this Green New Deal story I'm working on? She said, sure. And she did. She gave me a good quote on it. So I was real happy about that. It's up on my blog now.
Okay.
In the piece on there. So you know, hey, you live and you learn. So,
yep.
I'm not saying that, you know, when the stuff I've written about her when she was in the state legislature is null and void. Obviously, it's not. I mean, I had the, you know, what I did is I published the official minutes of the state legislature in Hawaii so people could see what I was talking about. So that you know, you can't take that back. It's
right.
there.
Sure.
But on the other hand, you know, I now see, I'm trying to see the positive things about a person as well. You know, people say to me, you know, constantly now, are asking me about Beto. Because
yes.
when Beto was when Beto first ran for Congress, you know, he had been on the city council, and I know him. He's a musician,
right?
And Blue America endorsed him in his very first run, and we spent quite a bit of money on him, not just raising money for him, but we did some independent expenditures as well. So that was his first run. He ran against a very corrupt conservative Democrat. And in a primary, and he won, and then of course in the general election he won, and then after that, so Beto was in for three terms,
right?
And he had said right from the beginning he's only going to run three times. He said for the House, he said he's not going to make a career out of being in the House, and he put his own time limits on himself, you know, which is an admirable thing to do, and I admired that he did that. And there were other things about him that I admired. For example, he wrote a book about marijuana legalization, and that was, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. And that, you know, now it's a much more accepted thing by people in Congress. But when he wrote it, it was not accepted at all. And when it comes to immigration reform, he's one of the best. I mean, you're not going to, you know, find many people as good as he is on that.
Right.
The other thing is he, I don't know that he was the very first, but if he wasn't the first, he was definitely one of a tiny handful of members of Congress who announced and lived up to, I will not take corporate PAC money.
Huh.
And he never did and never does. So, you know, so those are some really good things about him. On the other hand, you know, Blue America never re-endorsed him for Congress because he was, you know, okay, but we're not looking for people who are okay.
Right.
We're looking for people who are great. And I didn't feel that across the board he was. He joined the New Dems.
Right.
He tended to be a little bit, you know, a little bit centrist for what we're looking for at Blue America. I mean, not John, not Digby, not Jackie. None of us felt like, wow, we only endorse about 10 incumbents a year anyway. Mostly we're looking to help people who are running the first time.
Sure.
But to be endorsed by us as an incumbent, you've got to be, you know, you've got to be on a level of someone like Ted Lieu, you know, not someone who's just okay.
Right.
So now that Beto is running for president, or there's lots of rumors that he's running for president, or he's floating trial balloons that he might run for president, you know, it puts me in a little bit of an awkward situation because, yeah, I like this guy. Do I think he would be the best president? No.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think he's ready to be president? No. Do I think his policies are what I'm looking for in a president? No.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to write about that. I mean, I feel it's my duty
sure.
to try to explain all this to people. You know, and on the other hand, I don't want to like diss the guy. I mean, I, you know, personally, I like him.
Right.
but got to do it.
Right. And what, but he's not going to be one of the worst Democrats who want to be president.
No, definitely not. Those are the bad guys. Bernie's not a bad guy.
Right.
You know, that's like Michael Bloomberg, you know,
yes.
or Kirsten Gillibrand.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like really bad people who, if they get to become president, where, you know, I'm not going to say we're in as bad shape as we are with Trump.
Right.
That would be hard, but we're not in good shape. We're not getting better by having people like Kirsten Gillibrand as president, or someone like Michael Bloomberg,
or the latest one, the number four on your list, which is Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, that's a tough one. If he's going to be more than number four, I'm going to have to write about him quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
But you know, Joe Biden has been running for president since late 70s.
Yes, he has.
I've never liked him. I've never thought he would be any good. And America has always agreed with me. He never got beyond 1% in support. And, you know, the media, the Beltway media and the insiders love him. They push him and they always say, you know, they try to make up nonsense that he's a front runner and this kind of silliness. And people just don't like him, haven't.
Right.
And now he's got this Obama thing attached to him. So people think, oh, yeah, we can't have Obama, but we'll have Joe Biden. And that's a big mistake. I mean, Joe Biden has spent a whole career being a patsy for the banking industry and the
credit cards
business.
Delaware.
And he's just not, you know, again, there's some good things about him, I'm sure. And I'm not 100% sure what they are, but there are definitely some good things about him, I hear. And but to be president, come on.
Yeah.
We have a chance to have Bernie Sanders to be president. We have a chance to have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have someone great.
Yeah.
The difference.
Yeah, I agree.
Between someone great and someone, you know, who might be okay, or someone who's just, oh, he's better than Trump. No, we have a chance for the real thing. That doesn't happen.
Right.
All the time. We haven't had a great president, and I don't want people flipping out now, but we haven't had a great president since FDR.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I agree with you. Yeah, well, we haven't. And and that's what we need right now.
To have Bernie Sanders.
That's right.
The real thing.
Yep.
Bernie, he has a vision. He wants to do something to move this country in a real way. And you know, and instead we're going to go for another status quo person?
No. Well, I mean, I don't think the American people
stand for it. While I was... looking, you know, writing this thing, I thought of something which I'm very proud of.
Okay.
So the election will be in 2020. In 1920, exactly 100 years, right? One century goes by. But in 1920, we elected a president. And that president was a really worthless guy named Warren G. Harding. I'm sure very few people can tell me anything good about Warren G. Harding. But Warren G. Harding ran on Biden's platform, which is a return to normalcy.
Ooh.
If there's one thing that historians know, or people who are interested in history know about Warren G. Harding, it's that return to normalcy. That was
mm-hmm.
his campaign theme, return to normal. And that is exactly Biden. He's running against Trump as a return to normalcy. But, you know, don't we need something better than that? Otherwise, we'll wind up in a cycle of one like Biden and then one like Trump and then another one like Biden and another one like Trump.
Right.
We need something real. Biden is like, you know, it's like another, gonna be another Hillary.
Yeah, we need a game changer. We need somebody who is a revolutionary figure like FDR and Bernie to me. So I guess we'll see. It's game on. Howie Klein, find him.
So we will all agree.
Yep. I think so. I still encourage people to read your series, The Worst Democrats Who Want to Be President. I'll put a link up on my blog today at NicoleSandler.com. As always, Howie, thank you so much. Loved hearing the story about meeting Bernie, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. Okay. I'm going home from the hospital now.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Howie. Take care. Bye-bye. Howie Klein, everyone. Find him on Twitter at DownWithTyranny, DownWithTyranny, and, of course, at DownWithTyranny.com and the Blue America Pack. I'll put up links to both of them. All right, we've run long today, so I'll fix this up to get it on the air at Progressive Voices at 6. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Deborah Newell-Tornello will be here. It's time to have a day of poking fun at Florida, so we'll do that and see what else the day brings. As always, thank you for listening. I'll speak to you tomorrow. as I used to say, radio or not. Bye, everyone.